don't know. I didn't make it up. Okay. Let's see. Oh, I want to show off a couple more books real quick. Oh, this one. Who was it that referred to Helena Norberg Hodge and her work? Oh, whoa. That woman is amazing. And her... There's literature out there on this table, but this is not. This is a little booklet that she and her group, the Institute for... I don't know what it's called. ISEC. It's called Small is Beautiful, Big is Subsidized. And this is a powerful thing. I wish I had had the forethought to order a bunch of them and have them for sale here, because it gives you all the facts that you need about multinational corporations and how your tax dollar supports them instead of you. So this is a powerful piece. I've held up this permaculture book. It's great. This permaculture book is much more of the hands-on. It's the first book written about North America, permaculture in North America. This is the hands-on how to do it in your backyard and in your community, the physical landscape stuff. It's called Gaia's Garden by Toby Hemingway. All these books are at the Earth Haven display, so you can come and write down stuff later.
What is Earth Haven?
I wanted to invite folks. I know we're talking about tables, so people who wanted to would like to hear more about Earth Haven, Earth Haven Eco Village, a permaculture-based community at which I live. We could perhaps have a table at lunch. That's the best I think that we can offer. Okay. Yeah, let's do a few questions. I personally don't pay them. I made that choice 20-something years ago. But I also keep myself poor enough so that if I was going to be having to fill out those forms, they'd give me money back. So, taxation. I honestly don't have a lot to say about that subject. I mean, I couldn't go into the details of how we are taxed at Earth Haven. We're a not-for-profit, but we do have to pay taxes, not on the land, but on the buildings. So that's about all.
Are you aware of the Permaculture Credit Union?
Yes.
I thought I was going to hear about that this weekend. I've been waiting to hear about it.
Well, there is a Permaculture Credit Union, and it comes out of Santa Fe, New Mexico. A guy named Scott Pittman is the person who is sort of a focalizer of it. They loan money for sustainable projects. Now, it's just like any other credit union or bank. You got to have some collateral or all that kind of stuff. But it's a way they will loan you money to buy a hybrid car, to insulate your house, to get solar panels, etc., to take a permaculture course. They will loan you money to take a permaculture course. So,
and it's a good way to save your money, because then you know that what you're saving, your savings are doing good work.
That's right. So it's definitely an very ethical investment.
It's a national, anybody can belong to it,
right,
that believes in permaculture. And instead of saving your money in a bank where you wonder, what on earth are they doing with my money,
You
could be helping people start up organic farms.
Absolutely, yeah.
Regarding chemicals in the ground, such as urban gardens, is it much of a concern to worry about lead and other chemical residues in the ground?
Yes. My understanding is certainly you just have to be aware. So you're not going to have a garden near or right around where an older building has been, one that's old enough to have had lead paint. You're not going to have a garden on the edge of a highway that's been active since before we changed to the non-leaded gas.
And Patricia, if you go ahead and push your organic matter level in your garden soil to 40%, the lead gets tied up as salts and not available to plants. So you can test it in the soil, but it won't be in your plants. So
yes.
Urban gardens are usually half compost and half soil for that reason.
That's right, yeah. And I just want to segue onto that You do that to start. This is something I wish I could teach a whole seminar on. This is a woman named Amelia Hazlip who's doing synergistic gardening. She doesn't import anything. And she's a market gardener in the south of France. Well, she just died, but... Hazlip, H-A-Z-E-L-I-P. She doesn't import anything. She doesn't import manures. She doesn't import rock powders. She doesn't import anything. Synergistic gardening, allowing the critters and the plants to feed each other. I got to hold up one more book because somebody talked about using human waste. If you haven't seen the book Humanure Handbook, please look at this. It'll be over there. This tells you how to handle it safely and efficiently and returning that human nutrient residue, remember we don't call it waste, to the soil. Because if you eat your food and then though that nutrient residue goes away, you are depleting your soil and you cannot be sustainable. This is a must for all of us. Okay. All right. Blessings. Thank you.
That was permaculturist Patricia Allison speaking last month at the first annual conference on peak oil and community solutions. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, 91.3 Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. For listeners in the Finger Lakes wanting to learn more about permaculture, the Finger Lakes Permaculture Network will be having an open discussion at 7 p.m. on Thursday, December 9th, upstairs at Autumn Leaves Used Books on the Ithaca Commons. Topics include peak oil, food sovereignty, and local action on these fronts. Attendees are invited to bring a snack to pass and bring your own plate. And a two-day bioenergy workshop will be held at Cornell University on December 8th and 9th during daytime hours, featuring various speakers on value-added bioenergy products, energy self-sufficiency, and climate change mitigation. The event will take place at 135 Emerson Hall. For more information, contact Jenny Whiteman. Her email is jw93@cornell.edu, jw93@cornell.edu, or telephone 255-4230, 255-4230.
Our grandparents were born here. Our ancestors lived with this earth. Land is the people, and the people are the land, and this is the land of our birth. But now you want to move us off this mesa, as if you can take a body from a soul. You wanna take from us our paradise on earth and trade it for a mountain of coal. What if they were coming for your grandma? What if they were coming for your child? What if they were tearing up the ground beneath your feet, even taking the rivers that were once running wild? What would you do if they were coming for you? The liver of our mother, and it must remain in the ground. The trees are her lungs, and the rivers are her blood, and they should all be left as they were found. But now you slurry coal across these pastures, and your trees all go to feed your hungry mill. You would have us live in rows of shacks without our sheep on your church rock uranium spill. What if they were coming for your grandma? What if they were coming for your child? What if they were tearing up the ground beneath your feet, even taking the rivers that were once running wild? What would you do if they were coming for you?
To conclude the program, I wanted to play you a talk that was not part of the conference, but resonates so well with some of the ideas just presented by Patricia Allison on the transformation of human culture and our concepts of progress as they relate to living sustainably. The speaker is Ronald Wright, an author and archaeologist who has written extensively on the peoples and cultures in the American continents before the arrival of the Europeans. Last month, he gave a series of lectures called A Short History of Progress as part of the public Massey Lecture Series in Canada. What we're about to hear is the first in that series of lectures. He titled it Gauguin's Questions. Who are we? Where did we come from? Where are we going? Ronald Wright.
It really is a great honor for me to be giving these lectures and a great pleasure to kick them off here in Ottawa. And on Guy Fawkes Night, I don't know how many people here know that it's Guy Fawkes Night, but by a strange coincidence, it is the 399th anniversary to the day of the gunpowder treason plot against the Westminster Parliament, not the one over there, which actually I think, we used to, in England, learn this little rhyme, remember, remember, the 5th of November, gunpowder treason plot. And I think it really is worth remembering now because it tells us that the war on terror and the various manipulations of that have been with us for a very long time. So, the first hour, the first of the Massey Lectures, Gauguin's Questions. The French painter and writer Paul Gauguin, by most accounts mad, bad, and dangerous to know, suffered acutely from cosmological vertigo induced by the work of Darwin and other Victorian scientists. In the 1890s, Gauguin ran away from Paris, from family and a stockbroking career, to paint and to bed native girls in the tropics. Like many a troubled soul, he could not escape so easily from himself, despite great efforts to do so with the help of drink and opium. At the bottom of his disquiet lay a longing to find what he called the savage, primordial man and woman, humanity in the raw, the elusive essence of our kind. This quest eventually drew him to Tahiti and other South Sea islands, where traces of a pre-contact world, an unfallen world in his eyes, lingered beneath the cross and tricolour. In 1897, after he'd been there quite a long time, a mail steamer docked at Tahiti, bringing terrible news. Gauguin's favorite child, Aline, had died suddenly from pneumonia. After months of illness, poverty, and suicidal despair, the artist managed to harness his grief to produce a vast painting, more a mural in conception than a canvas, in which, like the Victorian age itself, he demanded new answers to the riddle of existence. He wrote the title boldly on the image, Three Childlike Questions, simple yet profound. Where do we come from? What are we? Where are we going? The work is a sprawling panorama of enigmatic figures amid scenery that might be the groves of heathen Tahiti or an unruly Garden of Eden. Worshippers or gods, cats, birds, a resting goat, a great idol, and a young human pair who, the artist wrote, dare to consider their destiny. Gauguin's third question, where are we going, is what I want to address in these talks. It may seem unanswerable. Who can foretell the human course through time? But I think we can answer it in broad strokes by answering the other two questions first. If we see clearly what we are and what we've done, We can recognize human behaviors that persist through many times and cultures. And knowing these can tell us what we are likely to do and where we are likely to go from here. Our civilization, which subsumes most of its predecessors, is a great ship steaming at speed into the future. It travels faster, further, and more laden than any before. We may not be able to foresee every reef and hazard, but by reading her compass bearing and headway, by understanding her design, her safety record, and the abilities of her crew, we can, I think, plot a wise course between the Narrows and bergs looming ahead. And I believe we must do this without delay, because there are too many shipwrecks behind us. The vessel we are now aboard is not merely the biggest of all time, it's also the only one left. The future of everything we've accomplished since our intelligence evolved will depend on the wisdom of our actions over the next few years. Like all creatures, humans have made their way in the world so far by trial and error. Unlike other creatures, we have a presence so colossal that error is a luxury we can no longer afford. The world has grown too small to forgive us any big mistakes. Despite certain events of the 20th century, most people in the Western cultural tradition still believe in the Victorian ideal of progress, a belief succinctly defined by the historian Sidney Pollard in 1968 as the assumption that a pattern of change exists in the history of mankind, that it consists of irreversible changes in one direction only, and that this direction is towards improvement. Our technological culture measures human progress by technology. The club is better than the fist, the arrow better than the club, the bullet better than the arrow. So we came to this belief for empirical reasons, because it delivered. Pollard notes that the idea of material progress is a very recent one, significant only in the past 300 years or so, coinciding with the rise of science and industry and the corresponding decline of traditional beliefs. We no longer give much thought to moral progress, a prime concern of earlier times, except to assume that it goes hand in hand with the material. Civilized people, we tend to think, not only smell better, but behave better than barbarians or savages. Well, this notion has trouble standing up in the court of history, and I shall return to it in the next lecture when considering what is meant by civilization. Our practical faith in progress has ramified and hardened into an ideology, a secular religion which, like the religions that progress has challenged, is blind to certain flaws in its credentials. Progress, therefore, has become myth in the anthropological sense. And by this I don't mean a belief that is flimsy or untrue. Successful myths are powerful and often partly true. As I've written elsewhere, myth is an arrangement of the past, whether real or imagined, in patterns that reinforce a culture's deepest values and aspirations. Myths are so fraught with meaning that we live and die by them. They are the maps by which cultures navigate through time. The myth of progress has sometimes served us well, those of us at the best tables anyway, and may continue to do so. But I shall argue in these talks that it's also become dangerous. Progress has an internal logic that can lead beyond reason to catastrophe. A seductive trail of successes may end in a trap. Take weapons, for example. Ever since the Chinese invented gunpowder, there has been great progress in the making of bangs. From the firecracker to the cannon, from the petard to the high explosive shell. And just when high explosives were reaching a state of perfection, progress found the infinitely bigger bang within the atom. But when the bang we can make can blow up our world, we've made rather too much progress. Several of the scientists who created the atomic bomb recognized this in the 1940s, telling politicians and others that the new weapons had to be destroyed. Albert Einstein wrote, "The unleashed power of the atom has changed everything save our modes of thinking, and we thus drift toward unparalleled catastrophes." And a few years later, President Kennedy said, "If mankind does not put an end to war, war will put an end to mankind." When I was a boy in the 1950s, the shadow of too much progress in weaponry of Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and a number of vaporized Pacific islands had already fallen over the world. It has now darkened our lives for about 60 years, and so much has been said on the subject that I needn't add more. My point here is that weapons technology was merely the first area of human progress to reach an impasse by threatening to destroy the planet on which it developed. At the time, this progress trap was seen as an aberration. In all other fields, including those of nuclear power and chemical pesticides, the general faith in progress was largely unshaken. Advertisements of the 1950s showed a smiling Mrs. 1970, who, having bought the right brand of vacuum cleaner, was enjoying the future in advance. Each year's motor car looked different from the previous year's, especially if it wasn't. And peasants were freed from vermin with generous dustings of DDT in what became known as the Third World. So in both its capitalist and communist versions, the great promise of modernity was progress without limit and without end. The collapse of the Soviet Union led many to conclude that there was really only one way of progress after all. In 1992, Francis Fukuyama, a former U.S. State Department official, declared that capitalism and democracy were the end of history, not only its destination, but its goal. Doubters pointed out that capitalism and democracy are not necessarily bedfellows, citing Nazi Germany, modern China, and the worldwide archipelago of sweatshop tyrannies. Yet Fukuyama's naive triumphalism strengthened a belief, mainly on the political right, that those who have not chosen the true way forward should be made to do so for their own good, by force if necessary. In this respect, and in the self-interest it obscures, the current ideology of progress resembles the missionary projects of past empires, whether 7th century Islam, 16th century Spain, or 19th century Britain. Since the Cold War ended, we have held the nuclear genie at bay, but haven't begun to stuff it back in its bottle. Yet we're busy unleashing other powerful forces: cybernetics, biotechnology, nanotechnology, that we hope will be good tools, but whose consequences we cannot foresee. The most immediate threat, though, may be nothing more glamorous than our own waste. Like most problems with technology, pollution is a problem of scale. The biosphere might have been able to tolerate our dirty old friends, coal and oil, if we'd burned them gradually. But how long can it withstand a blaze of consumption so frenzied that the dark side of this planet glows like a fanned ember in the night of space? Alexander Pope said, rather snobbishly, that a little learning is a dangerous thing. Thomas Huxley later asked, "Where is the man who has so much as to be out of danger?" Technology is addictive. Material progress creates problems that are, or seem to be, soluble only by further progress. Again, the devil here is in the scale. A good bang can be useful, a better bang can end the world. So far, I've spoken of such problems as if they were purely modern, arising from industrial technologies. But while progress strong enough to destroy the world is indeed modern, the devil of scale, who transforms benefits into traps, has plagued us since the Stone Age. This devil lives within us and gets out whenever we steal a march on nature, tipping the balance between cleverness and recklessness, between need and greed. Paleolithic hunters who learned how to kill two mammoths instead of one had made progress. Those who learned how to kill 200 by driving a whole herd over a cliff had made too much. They lived high for a while, then starved. Many of the great ruins that grace the deserts and jungles of the earth are monuments to progress traps, the headstones of civilizations which fell victim to their own success. In the fates of such societies, once mighty, complex, and brilliant, lie instructive lessons for our own. Their ruins are shipwrecks that mark the shoals of progress, or, to use a more modern analogy, they are fallen airliners whose black boxes can tell us what went wrong. In these talks, I want to read some of these boxes in the hope we can avoid repeating past mistakes of flight plan, crew selection, and design. Of course, our civilization's particulars differ from previous ones, but not as much as we like to think. All cultures, past and present, are dynamic. Even the most slow-moving were, in the long run, works in progress. While the facts of each case differ, the patterns through time are alarmingly and encouragingly similar. We should be alarmed by the predictability of our mistakes, but encouraged that this very fact makes them useful for understanding what we face today. Like Gauguin, we often prefer to think of the deep past as innocent and unspoiled, a time of ease and simple plenty. Eden and paradise feature prominently in popular book titles on anthropology and history. For some, Eden was the pre-agricultural world, the age of hunting and gathering. For others, it was the pre-Columbian world, the Americas before the white man. And for many, it was the pre-industrial world, the long stillness before the machine. Certainly, there have been good and bad times to be alive. But the truth is that human beings drove themselves out of Eden, and they've done it again and again by fouling their own nest. If we want to live in an earthly paradise, it is up to us to shape it, to share it, and look after it. In pondering his first question, where do we come from? Gauguin might have agreed with G.K. Chesterton, who remarked, "If it is not true that a divine being fell, then we can only say that one of the animals went entirely off its head." We now know much more about that 5 million year process of an ape going off its head. So it's hard nowadays to recapture the shock felt around the world when the implications of evolutionary theory first became clear. Writing in 1600, Shakespeare had Hamlet exclaim, "What a piece of work is a man! How noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in action how like an angel, in apprehension how like a god." His audience would have shared Hamlet's mix of wonder, scorn, and irony at human nature. But very few, if any, would have doubted that they were made as the Bible told. And God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." They were prepared to overlook theological rough spots posed by sex, race, and hair color. Was God black or blonde? Did he have a navel? And what about the rest of his physical equipment? Such things didn't bear thinking about too closely. Our kinship with apes, which seems so obvious now, was unsuspected. Apes were seen, if seen, which was rarely in Europe in those days, as parodies of man, not cousins or possible forebears. If they thought about it at all, most people of 1600 believed that what we now call scientific method would simply open and illuminate the great clockwork set in place by Providence. as God saw fit to let humans share in admiration of his handiwork. The inevitable collision between scriptural faith and empirical evidence was barely guessed at. Most of the really big surprises, the age of the earth, the origin of animals and man, the shape and scale of the heavens, still lay ahead. Most people of 1600 were far more alarmed by priests and witches than by natural philosophers, though the lines between these three were often unclear. From the biblical definition of man and the common sense principle that it takes one to know one, Hamlet thinks he knows what a human being is, and most Westerners continued to think they knew what they were for another 200 years. The rot of rational doubt on the matter of our beginnings did not set in until the 19th century, when geologists realized that the chronology in the Bible could not account for the antiquity they read in rocks, fossils, and sediments. Some civilizations, notably the Hindu and the Maya, assumed that time was vast or infinite, but ours always had a petty notion of time's scale. "The poor world is almost 6,000 years old," sighs Rosalind in As You Like It. Half a century later, Archbishop Usher of Armagh and his contemporary John Lightfoot took it upon themselves to pinpoint the very moment of creation. "Man was created by the Trinity," Lightfoot declared, "on October the 23rd, 4004 BC, at 9 o'clock in the morning." Such precision was new, but the idea of a young earth had always been essential to the Judeo-Christian view of time as teleological, a short one-way trip from creation to judgment, from Adam to doom. Newton and other thinkers began to voice doubts about this on theoretical grounds, but they had no real evidence or means of testing their ideas. Then, in the 1830s, while the young Charles Darwin was sailing around the world aboard the Beagle, Charles Lyell published his Principles of Geology, arguing that the Earth transformed itself gradually by processes still at work and might therefore be as old as Newton had proposed, some 10 times older than the Bible allowed. Under Queen Victoria, the Earth aged quickly, by many millions of years in decades, enough to make room for Darwin's evolutionary mechanism and the growing collection of giant lizards and low-browed fossil humans being dug up around the world. In 1863, Lyell brought out a book called Geological Evidences of the Antiquity of Man, and in 1871, Darwin published The Descent of Man. Their ideas were spread by enthusiastic popularizers, above all Thomas Huxley, famous for saying in a debate on evolution with Bishop Wilberforce that he would rather acknowledge an ape for his grandfather than be a clergyman careless with the truth. Hamlet's exclamation, therefore, became a question. What exactly is a man? Like children who reach an age when they're no longer satisfied that a stork brought them into the world, a newly educated public began to doubt the old mythology. By the time Gauguin was painting his masterpiece at the end of the century, the first two of his questions were getting concrete answers. By 1907, Boltwood and Rutherford could show that the Earth's age is reckoned not in millions of years, but in billions. Archaeology showed that the genus Homo was a latecomer, even among mammals, taking shape long after early pigs, cats, and elephants began walking the Earth, or in the case of whales, gave up walking and went swimming. "Man," wrote H.G. Wells, "is a mere upstart." What was extraordinary about human development, the one big thing that set us apart from other creatures, is that we leveraged natural evolution by developing cultures transmissible through speech from one generation to the next. "The human word," Northrop Frye wrote in another context, "is the power that orders our chaos." The effect of this power was unprecedented, allowing complex tools, weapons, and elaborate planned behaviors. Even very simple technology had enormous consequences. Basic clothing and built shelter, for example, opened up every climate from the tropics to the tundra. We moved beyond the ecologies that had made us and began to make ourselves. But though we became experimental creatures of our own devising, it's important to bear in mind that we had no inkling of this process, let alone its consequences, until only the last 6 or 7 of our 100,000 generations. We've done it all sleepwalking. Nature let a few apes into the lab of evolution, switched on the lights, and left us there to mess about with an ever-growing supply of ingredients and processes. The effect on us and on the world has accumulated ever since. What strikes me most forcefully is the acceleration, the runaway progression of change, or, to put it another way, the collapsing of time. From the first chipped stone to the first smelted iron took nearly 3 million years. From that first iron to the hydrogen bomb took only 3,000. The old Stone Age, or Paleolithic era, lasted from the appearance of tool-making hominids nearly 3 million years ago until the melting of the last ice age only 12,000 years ago. It therefore spans more than 99.5% of human existence. During most of that time, the pace of change was so slow that entire cultural traditions replicated themselves generation after generation, almost identically, over staggering periods of time. It might take 100,000 years for a new style or technique to be developed. Then, as culture began to ramify and feed on itself, only 10,000. Then mere thousands and centuries. Cultural change begat physical change and vice versa. Now we have reached such a pass that the skills and mores we learn in childhood are outdated by the time we're 30. But I'm getting ahead in the story. Most people living in the old Stone Age would not have noticed any cultural change at all. The human world that individuals entered at birth was the same as the one they left at death. It's possible to imagine exceptions to what I've just said. The generation that saw the first use of fire, for instance, was perhaps aware that its world had changed. But we can't be sure how quickly even that Promethean discovery took hold. Most likely, fire was used when available from wildfires and volcanoes for a long time before it was kept. And then it was kept for a very long time before anyone learnt it could be made. Some may remember the 1981 film Quest for Fire, in which the lithe figure of Ray Dawn Chong scampers about in nothing but a thin layer of mud and ashes. The film was based on a novel published in 1911 by the Belgian J.H. Rosny, and his original title was The War for Fire. The book, more than the film, depicts deadly competition between various human groups to monopolize fire in much the same way that modern nations try to monopolize nuclear weapons. Throughout the hundreds of centuries when our ancestors tended a flame but could not make one, putting out their rivals' campfire in an ice age winter would have been a deed of mass murder. The first taming of fire is hard to date. All we know is that people were using fire by at least 500,000 years ago, possibly twice that. This was the time of Homo erectus, the upright man, who was much like us from the neck down, but whose brain case had only about 2/3 the modern capacity. Anthropologists are still debating when Homo erectus first appeared and when he and she were superseded, which is largely a matter of defining that evolutionary stage. Scholars are even more divided on how well erectus could think and speak. Modern apes, whose brains are much smaller than those of erectus, can use simple tools, have wide knowledge of medicinal plants, and can recognize themselves in a mirror. It is clear that different groups of the same species, for example, chimps in separate parts of Africa, have different habits and traditions passed on to the young, just as in human groups. In short, apes have the beginnings of culture. So do other intelligent creatures, such as whales, elephants, and certain birds. But no species, except humankind, has reached the takeoff point at which culture becomes the main driver of an evolutionary surge, outrunning environmental and physical constraints. The bloodlines of man and ape split about 5 million years ago, and as I mentioned, hominids making crude stone tools appear some 2 million years after that. It would therefore be foolish to underestimate the skills of Homo erectus, who, by the time he was toasting his calloused feet at a campfire 500,000 years ago, was 9/10 of the way along the road from an ancestral ape to us. About the last big thing the experts agree on is that Homo erectus originated in Africa, the home of all the early hominids, and by 1 million years ago was living in several temperate and tropical zones of the Old World, the contiguous Eurasian landmass. This isn't to say the upright man was thick on the ground, even after he tamed fire. Perhaps fewer than 100,000 people, scattered in family bands, were all that stood between evolutionary failure and the 6 billion of us here today. After Homo erectus, the evolutionary path gets muddy, trodden into a mire by rival tribes of anthropologists. One anthropological camp sees Homo erectus evolving by fits and starts into modern humanity wherever he happened to be, through gene diffusion, otherwise known as mating with strangers. This view seems to fit well with many of the fossil finds, but less well with some interpretations of DNA. Another camp, known as the Out of Africa School, sees most evolutionary change taking place on that continent only, then erupting over the rest of the world. In this second view, successive waves of new and improved humans kill off, or at any rate outcompete, their forerunners wherever they find them, until all the lowbrows are gone. This theory implies that each new wave of African man was a separate species, unable to breed with other descendants of the previous kind, which may be plausible if different types evolve without contact for long periods, but is less likely over the shorter spans of time. The debate over the path of human progress gets most heated when we reach our controversial cousins, the Neanderthals. These lived mainly in Europe and Northwest Asia in quite recent times, well within the last 1/20th of the human journey. In very round figures, Neanderthals appear about 130,000 years ago and disappear about 100,000 years later. Their arrival date is less certain than their departure, but it seems they evolved at about the same time as early examples of what is thought to be our modern kind, often called Cro-Magnon, after a rock shelter in the lovely Dordogne region of southern France, where the human fossil record is the richest in the world. Ever since they were first identified, Neanderthals have been the butt of what I call paleo-racism, lampooned as cartoon cavemen, a subhuman, knuckle-dragging breed. H.G. Wells called them the grizzly folk and made an unflattering guess at how they might have looked. An extreme hairiness, an ugliness, a repulsive strangeness. Many have claimed that Neanderthals were cannibals, which could be true, for so are we. Later humans have a long record of cannibalism right down to modern times. The first Neanderthal skeleton was unearthed in 1856 from a cave in a valley near Düsseldorf, Germany. The place had been named after the composer Joachim Neumann, who had rather affectedly rendered his surname into Greek as Neander. Englished, Neanderthal is simply Newmandale. Fitting enough, a new man had indeed come to light in the dale, a new man at least 30,000 years old. Not that Neanderthal man's seniority was recognized immediately. The French, noting the skull's thickness, were inclined to think it had belonged to a German. The Germans said it was most likely from a Slav, a Cossack mercenary who had crawled into the cave and died. But just 3 years later, in 1859, two things happened. Darwin published On the Origin of Species, and Charles Lyell, visiting the gravels of the River Somme, to become infamous not 60 years later as a human slaughterhouse, recognized ship flints as weapons from the Ice Age. Once the scientists of the day acknowledged that the Neanderthaler wasn't a Cossack, they cast him in the newly minted role of the missing link. The new man became the right man at the right time, the one who would show the unthinkable, that humans were animals. It was assumed that he had little or no power of speech, ran like a baboon, and walked on the outsides of his feet. But as more bones were unearthed and analyzed, this view didn't stand up. The most ape-like skeletons were found to be sufferers from osteoarthritis, severely crippled individuals who had evidently been supported for years by their community. Evidence also came to light that the so-called grizzly folk had not only cared for their sick, but also buried their dead with religious rites, with flowers and ochre and animal horns, the first people on Earth known to do so. And last but not least, the Neanderthal brain turned out to be bigger than our own. So perhaps Homo neanderthalensis was really not so brutish after all. Perhaps he deserved to be promoted to a subspecies of modern man, Homo sapiens neanderthalensis. And if that were so, the two variants could, by definition, have interbred. Before the two began to compete in Europe, the Cro-Magnons lived south of the Mediterranean and the Neanderthals north. Then, as now, the Middle East was a crossroads. Dwelling sites in that turbulent region show occupation by both Neanderthals and Cro-Magnons beginning about 100,000 years ago. We can't tell whether they ever lived there at exactly the same times, let alone whether they shared the Holy Land harmoniously. Most likely their arrangement was a kind of timeshare, with Neanderthals moving south out of Europe during especially cold spells, and Cro-Magnons moving north from Africa whenever the climate warmed. What is most interesting is that the material culture of the two groups, as shown by their artifacts, was identical over a span of more than 50,000 years. I take this as strong evidence that the two groups had very similar mental and linguistic capabilities, and that neither was more primitive or less evolved. No Neanderthal flesh, skin, or hair has yet come to light. So we can't say whether these people were brown or blonde, hairy as Esau, or smooth as Jacob. Nor do we know much about the Cro-Magnons' superficial appearance. We know them only by their bones. Both were roughly the same height, with the usual variation between sexes. But the Neanderthal was heavy-set and brawny, like a professional weightlifter or wrestler. The Cro-Magnon was slighter and more gracile, a track athlete rather than a bodybuilder. It's hard to know how far these differences were innate and how much they reflected habitat and lifestyle. In 1939, the anthropologist Carlton Kuhn drew an amusing reconstruction of a Neanderthal cleaned up, shaved, and dressed in a fedora, jacket, and tie. Such a man, Kuhn remarked, might pass unnoticed on the New York subway. As such analogies suggest, the variation between Neanderthal and Cro-Magnon skeletons does not fall far outside the range of modern humans. Put side by side, the bony remains of Arnold Schwarzenegger and Woody Allen might exhibit an even greater contrast. The skull, however, is another matter. The so-called classic Neanderthal had a long, low skull with strong brow ridges in front and a bony ledge across the nape of the neck known as the Neanderthal bun. The jaw was robust, the nose broad and presumably squat. At first glance, the design looks archaic. But as noted, the Neanderthal brain was bigger on average than the Cro-Magnon. Carlton Kuhn's subway rider had a thick skull, but not necessarily a thick head. What this adds up to, I think, is that the supposedly archaic characteristics of the Neanderthal were in fact an overlay of cold climate adaptations on an essentially modern human frame. Thick-set, brawny people don't lose body heat as quickly as slender people. Signs of similar adaptation, in body shape at least, can be seen among modern Inuit, Andeans, and Himalayans, and this after only a few thousand years of living with intense cold, beside the 100,000 during which Europe's Neanderthals made their living on the front lines of the Ice Age. Things seemed to have gone well enough for them until Cro-Magnons began moving north and west from the Middle East about 40,000 years ago. Until then, the cold had been the Neanderthals' great ally, always turning invaders back sooner or later. But this time, the Cro-Magnons came to stay. The invasion seems to have coincided with climatic instability, linked to sudden reversals of ocean currents that caused freezing and thawing of the North Atlantic in upsets as short as a decade. Such sharp changes, severe as the worst predictions we now have for global warming, would have devastated animal and plant communities on which the Neanderthals depended. Climate change would have made life difficult for everyone, of course, but the unstable conditions could have given the edge to the less physically specialized, weaker at close quarters, but quicker on their feet. I remember seeing a cartoon when I was a schoolboy, I think it was in Punch, showing three or four bratty Neanderthal children standing on a cliff badgering their father. "Daddy, Daddy, can we go and throw rocks at the Cro-Magnons today?" For about 10 millennia, from 40,000 to 30,000 years ago, the late Neanderthals and the early European Cro-Magnons probably did throw rocks at each other, not to mention dousing campfires, stealing game, and perhaps seizing women and children. At the end of that unimaginably long struggle, Europe and the whole world belonged to our kind, and the classic Neanderthal was gone forever. But what really happened? Did the Neanderthal line die out, or was it to some degree assimilated? The 10,000-year struggle was so gradual that it may have been scarcely perceptible, a fitful, inconclusive war with land lost and won at the rate of a few miles in a lifetime. Yet, like all wars, it sparked innovation. New tools and weapons appear, new clothing and rituals, the beginnings of cave painting, an art form that would reach its height during the last great fling of the Ice Age after the classic Neanderthals had gone. We also know that cultural contact went both ways. Late Neanderthal sites in France show change and adaptation at a pace never seen before. By then, near the end, the war's implications must have become dreadfully clear. It seems that the last Neanderthal bands held out in the mountains of Spain and Yugoslavia, driven like Apaches into rougher and rougher terrain. If the warfare picture I've sketched has any truth to it, then we face unpalatable conclusions. And this is what makes the Neanderthal debate so emotional. It is not only about ancient people, but about ourselves. If it turns out that the Neanderthals disappeared because they were an evolutionary dead end, we can merely shrug and blame natural selection for their fate. But if they were, in fact, a variant or race of modern man, then we must admit to ourselves that their death may have been the first genocide, or worse, not the first, merely the first of which any evidence remains. It may follow from this that we are descended from a million years of ruthless victories, genetically predisposed by the sins of our fathers to do likewise again and again. As the anthropologist Milford Wolpoff has written on this period, you can't imagine one human population replacing another except through violence. No, you can't, especially not on the blood-stained earth of Europe, amid Stone Age forebodings of the final solution and the slaughters of the Somme. In the aftermath of the Second World War, William Golding explored ancient genocide in his extraordinary novel, The Inheritors. The book's epigraph from H.G. Wells invokes Neanderthals, though the anthropological specifics fit better with much earlier stages of mankind. Yet Golding's anachronisms don't matter. His people may not fit any particular set of bones from the real past, but they stand for many. In the course of a few spring days, the supposedly more primitive folk are invaded for the first time by people like us, who, with their boats, bonfires, arrows, raucous voices, wholesale tree felling, and drunken orgies, baffle and fascinate the forest devils, as they call them, even as they kill them one by one. At the end, only a mewling baby survives, kept by a woman who has lost her own child to drain the milk from her breasts. The invaders then move on through the new land, their leader plotting further murders, murders now amongst themselves. Golding had no doubt that the ruthless were the winners of prehistory. But another question he raised is still unsettled. Does any Neanderthal blood flow in modern humans? How likely is it that during 10,000 years of interaction, there was no sex, unconsensual though it may have been? And if there was sex, were there children? DNA studies on Neanderthal remains have been inconclusive so far, but the skeleton of a child found recently in Portugal strongly suggests interbreeding, as do bones from Croatia and elsewhere in the Balkans. I also have personal evidence that Neanderthal genes may still be with us. A few modern people have telltale ridges on their heads, and I happen to have one. A bony shelf across the back of the skull that looks and feels exactly like the Neanderthal bun. So until new findings come along to settle the matter, I choose to believe that Neanderthal blood still flows, however faint, in the Cro-Magnon tide. Despite the many details of our ancestry still to be worked out, the 20th century did broadly answer the first two of Gauguin's questions. There is no room for rational doubt that we are apes, and that, regardless of our exact route through time, we come ultimately from Africa. But unlike other apes, we tamper, and are tampering more than ever, with our destiny. For a long time now, there has been no such thing as that Enlightenment wild goose which Gauguin sought, the natural man. Like those arthritic Neanderthals who were cared for by their families, we cannot live without our cultures. We have met the maker of Hamlet's piece of work, and it is us. Thank you very much.
And that was author and archaeologist Ronald Wright speaking last month in Ottawa. All of our episodes of Unwelcome Guests are archived on the web in MP3. These are available to anyone to download, to make copies, and distribute this information to people who may not have heard this program, and we encourage you to do so. Our website is in a transitionary period, so the best way to go directly to the audio is to go to www.radioforall.net, radio the numeral 4, ALL.net, and in the search engine type unwelcome. All the programs will come up in a long list. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening. The rich will come.